The faces in the stone. This is a legend from the far west of Ireland in two parts. The first tells of an act of sorcery unleashed 700 years ago against two barefoot wildling children. The second uncovers how that enchantment was broken by a stroppy teenage surfing addict called Kyle from Banninskellig, who up until that point had reckoned that magic was complete rubbish and wanted nothing whatsoever to do with it. This is part one. It's called The Silver and the Red. The sea storm screamed down the coast of Western Ireland on a dark November night 700 years ago. As it passed over Banninskellig village, two babies were battling their way into the world. They were born to different mothers within minutes of each other, between a clap of thunder and a flash of lightning. One boy, one girl. Huts were losing their straw roofs to the winds, flimsy dried mud walls being blown flat as terrified goats and chickens ran crazy loose. Children cried and men swore. So the newly delivered women were carried, wailing and clutching their babies, to the elegant little abbey that stood on the edge of the beach, its back to the land and its face to the raging Black Sea. So close to the water's edge, in fact, that on nights like these the waves washed its very walls, spattering its stained glass windows with the salt kisses of the ocean, making the abbot wonder for the millionth time why his predecessor had built it in such a stupid place. The abbey had faced down both Viking invaders who came roaring across the water riding long ships with dragon prows, and the soldiers of local chieftains little better than brigands who pillaged and raided when their own supplies of goats, weapons and women ran low. That building's walls were so thick and its doors so strong that none that sought refuge there had ever been harmed. What was more, its Benedictine monks might have been men of God, but they also found it wise to become decent shots with a bow and arrow, pointing out that prayers were all very well, but the Lord helps those who help themselves. Nor were they above pouring boiling water, cheerfully chanting psalms in Latin, from the abbey tower down onto the heads of the hairy marauders below, who up until that moment had never imagined that a bunch of balding wayfarers, prayer merchants in skirts could possibly give them any trouble. The infant Stormborns were named Geraldo and Madrigal, and the village thereafter blamed the circumstances of their birth for the way they grew up, disobedient, rebellious, and afraid of absolutely nothing. The children had swift feet, the curiosity of cats and rebel tongues that were never still. "Look! Did you hear? Did you see that? What's that? Can you eat it? My turn! Follow me!" The woods rang with their excited voices as they climbed trees, fell out of them, teased wild boar, stuck their hands in wasps' nests, slid down foxholes, rolled in river mud, argued with their elders, and stuffed so many berries that their mouths turned purple. Geraldo had the grey eyes of a watchful wolf cub and silver blonde hair. The Madrigal's caught fire when the sun struck it, and her dark blue eyes were centuries older than her years. Celtic wildlingers, they had no schooling. They had dirty necks and horn-hard feet from running barefoot through the forest all day. Their mothers could never find them when there was work to be done, and would call in vain for the children to take their rightful turn at wood-gathering, rabbit-skinning, water-drawing, or forcibly delousing the younger members of their families. Lazy, feckless, the village called them, and worse, as they routinely cuffed and scolded the pair for unauthorised absences and general cheek. Their parents existed in a permanent state of exasperation. How could they be raising such useless wild hearts and ferallings when the rest of their children were so helpful and obedient? Then one spring, when the pair were only 9 years old, it started raining as it does only in Ireland. Down it came in great grey sheets, battering the earth and pounding the sea. The only noise louder than that rain was the sound of Geraldo screaming. He had fallen head first down a sea cliff, trying to coax a passing puffin closer with a scrap of dried fish, and was lying with a splintered leg, bloodied head and broken ribs on the beach 60 feet below. A beach accessible only by boat. As the day wore on, his voice began to fail and he slipped in and out of consciousness, frozen by the rain, mind wandering, eyes closing. His throat was ripped raw by shouting, his shattered leg burned and his ribs stabbed with every breath he took. So he shouted out in his head instead with every atom of his remaining strength, "Madrigal! Madrigal! Help me!" 3 miles away, Madrigal, who had spent an exceptionally tedious day helping her mother and sisters stuff mud mixed with straw into the gaping cracks of their family's hut's roof, stopped dead. Her hands were full of mud goo and her head was on one side like a listening animal's, her midnight eyes staring at something the others could not see. "What?" demanded her mother. "What's the matter with you?" "Geraldo," she replied quietly, "I think he's hurt." "Oh, what makes you say that? More like he's not here because he's been made to do something useful for once, just like you," grumbled her mother, wiping hair out of her own eyes and leaving a great muddy splodge across her cheek. "Oh, get on with your work, if you please. The rain's still pouring in that corner over there. I want this finished by nightfall. And I'm telling you, there will be no supper for anyone round here until it's done." Madrigal took no notice, but simply wiped her muddy hands on the wall and ducked outside into the teeming rain. "And just where do you think you're going? Come back here this minute!" But her daughter was already heading for the beach, where she tucked up her skirt and dragged the little coracle boat her father used for fishing into the water. But inside her head, Gerardo's voice was getting louder. "Madrigal! Wolf's sister! Down here!" Squinting through the driving rain, she paddled furiously round the coast to the next cove, guided by an instinct for which she had no name. The child's hair hung like a nest of mouse tails. Water streamed into her eyes and her dress was soaked. "Hang on, Wolf brother," she thought back to him. "On my way." 20 minutes later, she was wading up the beach, dragging the little boat behind her, wet skirt billowing and tugging in the sea, running to her friend and throwing herself on the ground beside him. He opened one eye, then passed out cold. This was fortunate, for it meant he never did feel the pain from his injuries as the little girl dragged him back to the boat and somehow, she could never remember exactly how, heaved him in and paddled back to the abbey on the beach as fast as she could. She staggered into the courtyard, sodden and shouting, returning moments later with 2 monks carrying wooden planks which they lifted Geraldo onto and then followed them into the infirmary. The little girl watched, fascinated, as the monks swathed her friend's leg tightly in flax fibres, soaked in comfrey tincture, wrapped the whole thing in thick protective felt, and then strapped it all to 2 pieces of wood, finally binding his ribs with reeds and strips of linen. The elderly monk caught Geraldo's hopeful look and nodded curtly. 3 moons. "Oh, minimum." Hours later, Madrigal sat by him chewing a chunk of bread and sipping warm goat milk, surrounded by Geraldo's entire family of 2 parents, 2 brothers, 3 sisters, 4 aunts, 4 uncles, 14 cousins, 1 teething baby whose nappy needed changing, and a seriously muddy dog, all making a very great deal of noise. But relieved as he was, the boy's father had something on his mind. "Madrigal," he began, looking at her with an unsettling mixture of gratitude and suspicion. "Our family is very grateful to you. Very grateful indeed. You saved our son, child. And for this we truly bless you from the bottom of our hearts. But what I want to know is, how did you know where to find him?" Madrigal shrugged, then looked shifty. Geraldo, who was feeling considerably better thanks to the poppy juice mixed into his own cup of goat milk, grinned openly, but shook his head very slightly at her. The parents looked expectantly from one to the other. "Well?" The children exchanged a lightning look. How are they going to explain this one? We're not, said a voice in both their heads at once. So they didn't. Thereafter, they often voiced each other's thoughts or heard each other's words when none were spoken aloud. Yet they kept their gift a secret. In the village, there was now far less talk of the pair being lazy and feckless too, especially after they had somehow restored the hamlet's water supply when the well ran dry, cured the headman's cows of a deadly colic which looked set to kill a lot of them, and persuaded a very disruptive ghost to leave a neighbour's hut and go back where it came from. When asked how they had managed such things, especially the ghost, the children just looked vague, but added that the ghost had been easy, for they'd just talked to it. Farsighters, fairy-touched, elf-led, people began calling them, and started slipping them treats. A neck thong with a pretty metal bead on it for Madrigal, a chunk of honeycomb, a new leather tie for Geraldo's knife, and letting them off at far more work than was good for them. Elf-led? Yuck. More witch-taken and moon-dazzled, if you ask me, sniffed the local midwife suspiciously, who also served as local matchmaker, wise woman, old bat, and all-round resident crone. Those two might turn out useful one day, though, frankly, I really don't see how, unless one of them manages to get lost again. Or they'll bring us a whole dunghill of trouble. You mark my words. Gerardo and Madrigal said nothing, despite the resident crone's pursed lips. She always looked like she was sucking sloes whenever she spotted them, and the curious glances that came their way from everyone else. Because though they didn't think it was a good idea to mention it, each other's thoughts weren't the only things they could hear. For they ran with wolves, knew the language of bees, and could tell from the colour of dawn how soon spring would come and how brightly. They could hear messages in the way that yew trees grew, smell water, sense storms, and feel the hot prickle of danger long before it arrived in person. Then one day, when they were only 10 years old, something happened. Something pretty creepy. Geraldo was sent by his father to get 3 ells of reed rope from a man in Skellig Mary, the next village 5 miles away, in exchange for a sturdy leather bucket Geraldo's cousin had made. It wasn't actually raining, which meant it was a positively lovely day for late November on the wild Atlantic coast. He'd got barley bread in his pocket, the family dog at his heels, and Madrigal, as usual, by his side. So they sang as they walked along, picked up interesting stones, threw sticks for dog, spoke with a robin and generally enjoyed themselves. But arriving at the village, thirsty and hoping for some water, both stopped in their tracks. My skin's tickling, muttered Geraldo with a shiver. So's mine, whispered back Madrigal. Something's going to happen here, isn't it? Something not good. Not good? No, it's bad. Really bad, I reckon. We have to tell them. Unfortunately, the villagers had no time for 2 tousled 10-year-olds with dirt up their nails and warnings on their tongues. Despite Madrigal's pleading and Geraldo's arguing, which eventually turned into an all-out shouting match because no one would listen. But the noise they made reached the ears of the village's head man, who was sharpening knives on a whetstone in front of his hut. An old knee injury was hurting him today, and he was not in a very good mood. Yet he pricked up his ears when he heard raised voices and saw the pair being pushed away impatiently by the man in the dwelling across from his own. The headman watched with narrowed eyes and realised he knew these two. Well, knew of them anyway. His cousin was married to one of Madrigal's mother's 5 sisters, and word had got around the district about these children. Red hair, silver eyes, strange talk. It was those farsighter cubs. He limped over stiffly and tapped them on the shoulder. What's all this? They explained as best they could. So you see, it's ever so important you come with us, sir, finished Geraldo breathlessly. Look, you know our village, right? It's only little, but we've got 14 huts and a barn you could share. Just for a couple of days, urged Madrigal. We'll help you carry your stuff and everything. Then if nothing happens, you can just come back home and you won't have lost anything. Only 3 days' good work and the last decent weather we'll get this year, grumbled the headman. Winter's coming. Oh, hadn't you heard? Oh, push off, will you? We've got no time for your fairy tales. The children's shoulders drooped in defeat. But as he turned to go, Madrigal suddenly noticed that Gerardo had gone white. What is it, wolf brother? What do you see? A mouth, he whispered. A great dark mouth. It's opening. It's opening wider and wider. Where is this mouth? It is... it's here. Despite himself, the headman felt like a chill of cold air had passed over his heart, the very faintest of breaths. He hawked, spat over his shoulder and sucked his teeth for a minute. Yeah, there it was again, that coldness. He shivered and looked at the children more closely and saw not a desire to cause mischief, but only fear and sincerity in their upturned faces. The man scratched his backside and sighed. A couple of days, just to be on the safe side. At least it wasn't far. Oh, all right, since you make such a point of it. And anyway, you'll have already worried the women here witless with your stories, so none will sleep sound tonight if we stay. Madrigal and Geraldo nodded vigorously. But if you're wrong, I will personally see to it that your backsides are turned so thoroughly you don't sit down for a week. In the end, all but one household, a young couple, their three children and the man's elderly mother, followed Geraldo and Madrigal back, the boy sprinting on ahead to warn his village they'd be having visitors. A bed space was found for every man, woman and child to put their blankets. Extra barley and roots were thrown into cooking pots, visiting goats and sheep tethered beside existing residents. All new hens corralled behind a hurriedly woven withy fence. And the village settled down for the night. 3 days later, Skellig Mary's headman returned to his village. Geraldo, Madrigal, their father, plus the oldest, wisest man from their own hamlet, had had a bad feeling that he couldn't explain but equally seemed unable to ignore, were at his back. At first, things looked exactly as they always had, but quieter. Too quiet. There were no birds singing. Not a breath of wind. And where was the family who had chosen to stay behind? No one felt much like calling out to them. So the headman very cautiously opened the door to their hut a few inches. His eyes took a little time to adjust to the dim interior. But when they did, they revealed there was nothing there apart from 5 piles of clothes lying on the floor. Each had what appeared to be a handful of sticky grey ash in its centre. Of the 5 family members who had lived there, there was no sign. Outside, the children fidgeted uneasily. Something's watching, muttered the boy, looking warily right and left, and it's not happy. The headman went from hut to hut, checking for damage or theft, and then finding none, ducked around behind the cow barn, intending to take a drink from the spring there that had watered his village for generations. He was shocked to find that the well, clear and bubbling high only 3 days before, was drier than a sun-bleached bone. And that feeling of being watched lasted all the way back to the children's own village, for they were indeed being spied upon. Watched by the hungry ones, and these beings were most displeased. Pristine water and... delicious human energy was what these creatures liked, and they'd been helping themselves to both for centuries on the quiet. Springs, streams, out-of-the-way wells, a hamlet here, a lonely farmstead there, sometimes the inhabitants of a small hillside watched her. On occasion, an entire village, provided it was well off the beaten track. The hungry ones had been all set to feast on the village of Skellig Mary. Yet thanks to the interference from two grubby half-wild children, they had been cheated, yes, they felt cheated, out of their feasting and left with what? A pathetic 5 humans. 3 of which had been very small indeed and barely worth bothering with. The hungry ones had no proper name, or at least none that anyone had ever heard spoken aloud. Shapeless, formless, they came from far beyond and lived cloaked in darkness, having strong wills but no bodies, thoughts but no minds, longings but no souls, and hunger. Always their hunger. After they'd visited a place, no one could ever understand what had happened. Empty houses? Piles of clothes? So apart from a few terrified conjectures whispered around far sides, or thoughts of, as suggested by the Catholic Church, divine intervention for the sins of humanity, people put the deserted homes and empty ramparts down to raiders. And as to the dried up wells and springs, they had no theories whatsoever. Foreign battle customs, they would say, shaking their heads. Taking our people away, naked as the day they were born, leaving their clothes behind to mock us. Disgusting. Those Viking barbarians have no shame. Yes, the hungry ones had quietly had things all their own way for many years. But this was the first time anyone had ever come between them and their intended victims. And they were determined that it would be the last. A shiver of unease rippled through their colony. Those two brats, troublesome, interfering, and yes, powerful. Surprisingly powerful for one so small. Fortunately, they do not yet realise the extent of their own abilities, and they will not be allowed to find out. Get them. Hunt them down. That night, the hungry ones hovered over the area, scanning every bit of forest, beach, riverbank, field and village. Their gaze fell upon Balin Skellig. There! In the darkness, 2 very bright little lights. Yes, we have them. Next day, every child in Balin Skellig was packed off to gather mushrooms in the forest and told not to come back till their baskets were full. November was an excellent time for fungi in Ireland. Seps, puffballs, chanterelles, all delicious, all good for the pot. Magical and her 2 sisters were sitting on the ground, putting everything they gathered into piles, according to whether it was tasty, more or less edible, or would give you the farting squits. They were elaborately ignoring Geraldo and the other boys, all of whom were absorbed in Piss Up a Tree, a contest designed to see who could send a yellow jet of wee furthest up an old oak's trunk. Nice, pronounced Magical's elder sister, looking firmly the other way. Like anyone cares, said the cousin, with the blistering scorn only found in 12-year-old girls putting down 13-year-old males. Boys, sniffed Madrigal. And then it came. A dark wind roaring in out of nowhere, blowing huts flat, ripping cloaks from shoulders, bending tree branches, sweeping up first Geraldo, then Madrigal. Smothering them in whirling fog, pinning their arms to their sides, spinning them round and round and up and up and up. They heard the piercing screams of the other children, but they could not shout back nor even catch their breath as they were swept up and up and up into the storm-spinning sky. When the wild wind stopped, the 2 friends could neither move nor speak. They tried to breathe, but there was no air. They tried to swallow, but their throats were closed. Their arms were too heavy to lift, their eyes sightless. They could not turn their heads, blink, speak, sob, or sigh. They heard the crash of waves and the scream of gulls and smelled salt. Suddenly, they felt themselves flying through the air and landing with a shattering crash. As the shock subsided, warily, they reached out to each other with their thoughts. Are you okay?
Yeah.
You?
Just about. What happened?
I don't know. But I think we're on a beach.
But why can't we see? Why can't we move? What's the matter with us?
I think... Well, I know this sounds mad. But I think someone has trapped us in a stone. Time passed. Days, weeks, decades, centuries of time. Gerardo and Madrigal could not tell how long, for there are no sunrises or sunsets to measure its passing. The children's minds shut down, and they slept. They slept and they slept a merciful magical sleep for 700 years, imprisoned hand in hand in a round little chunk of grey rock. Then one day, they were abruptly woken by a woman's excited voice and felt themselves being lifted up.
Look, Gom. Oh, do look. Oh, this one's so cute. See the pattern? It's like two little faces.
Inside the stone, the children, now half awake, dared to hope for rescue. It didn't happen. You and your imagination, laughed the man's voice. Chuck it away, Mora. We've got more beach stones back at the flat than we know what to do with already. Come on, let's go back to the car. And once again, Geraldo and Madrigal felt themselves flying through the air and landing with a jarring crash. Flat? Car? What were those? This happened several times over the next few decades. Again and again, they were chosen, lifted up and exclaimed over. Again and again, they were thrown away. Then on the first day of summer, last year... Hey, cool, murmured a new voice. The boys. Oh, here we go, thought Madrigal. He'll find another one he likes better in a minute and drop us again, just like all the rest. But then, sunsets and stars, the children felt the sway of a walk. 10 minutes later, a brief wobble. The boy had put the stone on the cluttered desk in his bedroom. That night, the boy, a 14-year-old surfing addict called Kyle, who lived at Inch Beach near Ballinskellig, slept appallingly. Asleep, he kept dreaming of two tousled children standing hand in hand, a boy and a girl, one with silver and one with red hair. They seemed to be looking at him with urgent appeal on their faces. Awake, he felt restless and thirsty and could not get those faces out of his mind. Asleep, he saw them even more clearly, and for some reason the sight of them made him almost unbearably sad. All night long, the images of those children burned into his brain, flickered behind his closed eyelids, and they would not let him rest.